And we're on. Okay. Our topic for tonight is the German Jewish wave of immigration to the United States in the 19th century. Okay. And even that description already is slightly erroneous, because we're going to see that it's not only a German Jewish wave of immigration. Jews will come from a wide variety of places in Europe. And so therefore we'll have to explain why it is that this popularly became known as the German wave. But let's examine the topic. So for Central European Jews in the middle third of the 19th century, America went from being a choice of destination for immigration to being the choice for immigration, that there almost was no other, that this was where everybody wanted to go. But the question is, how did Jews in Central Europe even know much about America? How did they know that they would even want to go there? So the answer is that there were travelers' accounts, there was poetry, there was fiction that idealized America already starting from the 1820s. There was even journalism doing so, because German Jewry had, or rather Central European Jewry had, a German language weekly publication, the newspaper, the Allgemeine Zeitung, starting in 1837. And it was a constant theme, the notion of escape to America, where the world, where things are good economically and where Jews are not oppressed. So the literature began in elite circles, the crowd that does a lot of reading, but then eventually entered into the popular literature of the masses, so that those even who were barely literate knew something about the wonders of America. Heinrich Heine and Edward Gans, who were two of the founders of the Society for Promotion of Culture Among the Jews, which was an early attempt at Wissenschaft des Judentum, said that America is the counterpoint to Europe, that it's democracy versus authoritarianism, that whereas in Europe there is no real freedom, the absolute monarchs or the dictatorial states are in charge, in America there's true democracy, there's true freedom. And in America, there would be a new birth of freedom for those who go there, who escape the travails of Europe. Now, Heine is famous for having done what? What did he do in his personal life? What did he do that we were not so proud of? He converted to Christianity. He was an apostate, a mishumad. So Heine converted out of Judaism to Christianity because it was his entryway into the culture of modern Europe, that he could not mix and mingle with the literati of Germany unless he was a goy. As a Jew, you could not do that in those years, in the 1820s and 1830s. However, unlike most other mishumadim, apostates, who then go on to sing the praises of their new religion, Heine never really was a Christian. He always was just a Jew who took a baptism. And he was proud of his Jewish heritage and regretted and was ashamed of the fact that he became a goy. And he said, quote, everyone over there in America can find salvation in his own way. Meaning, you're not coerced into supposedly finding salvation in the church in a way which is anathema to you, but you feel compelled for economic or political reasons. And then he said, even if all of Europe should become a single prison, there is still another loophole of escape, namely America. Now, when you say all of Europe is a one big prison, that reminds one of the Nazi era 100 years later, where literally all of continental Europe is one big prison. And the Jews of continental Europe in the 1930s and 40s were desperate to escape to America, except they couldn't do so. Now, letters from America written by family members provided the fullest and most accurate source of information about what life is like in the New World. Because the fictional literature, the poetry, it had an agenda and was short on specific details, and people could get carried away with themselves. But in the letters written back and forth, family members were honest with each other, honest about the prospects for material success, which is a good thing, but also honest about the difficult personal costs of achieving those goals. So this transatlantic correspondence had its pluses and its minuses, but it gave people an honest description of the truth. Okay. Now, the migration propelled itself. People were on the move because it made sense to be on the move. There were some schemes cooked up on both sides of the Atlantic, whether in America or in Europe, for an organized large-scale migration of Jews from Central Europe to the United States. But all of these schemes failed. Okay. Asher says, Germany was united in 1873 by Bismarck's blood and iron. Did such political turmoil add to the differences among German states contribute to the Jewish exodus? The answer is yes. The fact that the Jewish course of emancipation was not the same in all states, but rather was more advanced in some German principalities and was trailing in other principalities, led some people who were not as advanced in the course of emancipation to wonder whether they would ever achieve political equality. And that's a further reason to go, although it wasn't the primary reason to go. We're going to see the economic factor is the primary factor, not the political one. But the point of different German states being on different wavelengths in terms of emancipation is a factor for some. Okay, so there were schemes cooked up on both sides of the ocean for a well-organized migration, and it always failed. Why? It failed because it was superfluous. They didn't need it. There was a spontaneous groundswell to pick yourself up and go, and you didn't need to be part of a group of 500 people or 1,000 people or 5,000 people who are together going on some big ship off to some far shore. People would do it privately no matter what. It was self-perpetuating and largely self-financed, that most people paid their own way, although we'll see that in certain instances, people got help with passage, with the boat fare from the Kihila, from the community, which was happy to be rid of them. Okay. Now, there's only one of these organized attempts at migration that I want to mention, because it's the most famous, and anyone who studied American Jewish history knows about it, and that is Mordechai Emanuel Noah's 1825 idea of Ararat. What is Ararat? Well, who knows from the Bible? What was Ararat?
The mountain that Noah's Ark landed on.
Noah's Ark. Could you hear me?
Noah's Ark, good.
Noah's okay. Ark rested in, I think, Asia Minor, Ararat.
Correct.
Landed on that.
So Ararat is the site where Noah's Ark, Tevat Noach, comes to rest, all right, in the Bible. And so Mordechai Emanuel Noah comes up with the name Ararat as the place where he'll have a refuge for Jews, because number one, his name is Noah, so Noach, so that's it gives him a little props. And also because this refuge is going to be like Ararat was. If the mountain in the days of the biblical Noah was a haven for the last remnants of humanity, so too will this Ararat place in America be a refuge for the lost souls of Jewish Europe. Okay, so where is this location? It's on Grand Island in the Niagara River. So in upstate New York near the Canadian border, the Niagara River, Grand Island, will have a refuge called Ararat. Well, why did this happen? How did he come up with this idea? So Mordechai Emanuel Noah was the American consul in Tunis in 1815. And we mentioned this last week, that he was ousted from his position by President James Monroe because Emanuel Noah was a Jew, or at least so it appeared. And Isaac Harvey wrote a nasty letter to Monroe saying, you can't do this, it's America, you can't fire somebody for his religion. But while he was in Tunis, he traveled around and he saw the difficulties that were facing Jews in North Africa and in continental Europe. And especially after Napoleon's defeat at the Battle of Waterloo and the conservative Metternich reaction that took hold in Central Europe after the demise of the Napoleonic regime. So Jews tended to lose whatever rights that they had secured for themselves under French patronage. And it looked like things were becoming further and further removed from that glorious future of emancipation. Well, Mordechai Emanuel Noah wants to provide a solution for these people's problems, and that solution will be in the United States. So he induces a Christian friend of his to buy several thousand acres of land on Grand Island in the Niagara River. And Mordechai Emanuel Noah reasonably predicted that Ararat could become eventually a great trading post. It was near the Erie Canal, the Great Lakes, the Niagara Falls, and he predicted that water power would become a source of energy. So all this did come true, not for a Jewish state or a Jewish refuge in an Ararat in Grand Island, but rather the city of Buffalo, the state of New York, became this hub of economic activity because of the various waterways bordering Canada. Okay. Now, Mordechai Mendel Noah spent a lot of money advertising this scheme. He put it in all the newspapers. And on September 2nd, 1825, there was a big ceremony to lay the cornerstone for the project. There was cannon fire. There were Christian clergy. There were Freemasons. There are always Freemasons, of course, at any ceremony. And there were even Native American Indians, because Noah believed that they were the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Where did this ceremony take place? So it was impractical for it to take place on Grand Island because of transportation issues. So instead, it was held in the Buffalo Episcopal Church. So here, the restoration of a Jewish statehood or sovereignty or something is taking place in an Episcopal church. So Noah declared himself the judge and governor of Israel and issued an official proclamation. Now, who made him the judge and governor of Israel? Himself. It's like it was some guy in the Lower East Side in 1913 announced that he's the chief rabbi of the United States of America. And someone asked him, who made you the chief rabbi? And he said, the sign painter. Okay, so he was able to get away with it. Now, he announced the restoration of the Jewish state on Grand Island as a preliminary act prior to the restoration of the state in Palestine, Eretz Yisrael. So don't think this is in lieu of Shivat Zion. This is just a necessary stage before we can get to Shivat Zion. So kind of like Uganda was for Herzl, if you want to make a comparison. He commanded that a census of Jews be taken throughout the world. By the way, is a census allowed? Is a census allowed?
Yeah. There are two censuses. David HaMelech got really messed up for it.
Correct. David HaMelech was punished terribly for a census. There's a tradition we don't take a census, at least not a direct headcount. You have Machlis HaShekel as an alternative. Okay, so he does that too. So he issues a poll tax of 3 shekels silver per annum to be paid to his treasury by Jews everywhere. So instead of the Beis HaMikdash getting Machlis HaShekel, him, Mordechai Emanuel Noah's bank account somewhere in New York is going to get padded with a lot of shekels. Then he graciously permitted such Jews as wish to remain in their adopted homes to stay there. Now, what does that remind you of? If you want to stay in your homes, you can stay there. What does that remind you of?
Obamacare. You want it?
If you like your doctor, you can keep it? No. It reminds me of certain comments that were made in the early period of Zionism. Mm-hmm. It was made clear, especially in the Balfour Declaration, that not all Jews are being compelled to participate in this venture, but rather Jews shall be allowed to remain in their place of the dispersion and not lose their rights. Okay, so if you want to be a Jew who lives somewhere else, gesundheit, you could be a Jew somewhere else. What about Jewish soldiers in European armies? He told them to remain in the service of those armies until receiving further orders. You know, wait for further instructions. He also issued certain religious reforms, which would not go over well with the traditionalists. And he made a provision for the election of every 4 years of judges in Israel with deputies in every county in which there are Jews. Okay, so the Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Asarot, Sarei Alafim, right out of the Bible. He commanded the Jews throughout the world to cooperate with him and appointed as his commissioners a number of distinguished European Jews. He didn't ask them for their permission. He just did it. He said, you know, so-and-so is going to be my deputy in this country or that country. Did anything ever come of this plan? Why am I talking about this plan? The answer is nothing ever came of it at all. It's just a blip on the radar of history. Most probably, Mordechai Emanuel Noah never set foot on Grand Island. Probably he never did. The press mocked the project. They belittled him as being a lunatic, a crazy man. And the chief rabbi of Paris wrote that human beings are not supposed to try to hasten the hour of the redemption. Okay, we're not supposed to calculate the redemption, and we're not supposed to be dochek esakets, to push the hour of redemption forward. So Rabbi of Paris is saying, Manuel Noah is doing wrong in this effort. His heart may be in the right place, the Shem Shemayim, but he's making a grievous blunder. So he's a big joke. The foundation stone, engraved with the numbers 1825 on them, still exists and is sitting in a room in a warehouse in the Buffalo Historical Society. You can visit it on your next trip to Buffalo. So nothing really came of this, but we should bear in mind that, and for those of you who were with me last year, we discussed the beginnings of Zionism. Moses Hess is only 37 years later in 1862 when he puts forth ideas about the restoration of Jewish sovereignty somewhere in the world. Lav Dafka, not necessarily Palestine. So Manuel Noah is a forerunner to Moses Hess, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. Well, who came to America and why did they come? So the economic motive was primary. While there were some people trying to escape the political consequences of their participation in, let's say, the revolutions of 1848, and they had to hightail it out of Europe lest they be arrested for sedition. Yeah, there are a few people like that, but not too many. And some people were fleeing direct anti-Semitism targeting them specifically. Yeah, there are always a few people like that. But the vast majority left for economic reasons. Now, these are economic reasons that are specific to the Jews, because the Jews have restrictive laws holding them back from participation in the economy and holding them back from getting married and setting up families. So political conditions alone did not push Jews out, meaning it wasn't the emancipation that was the primary factor. And in fact, emancipation didn't stop Jews from fleeing. Just because you got voting rights or were technically on par as a citizen didn't mean your circumstance was all that good. Economically, it might be terrible, and you'd have still reason to leave. Okay, and in fact, in the 1850s and 60s, even after emancipation was secured in large parts of Central Europe, there was an uptick in immigration to America. One of the main reasons why the upswing happened in the 1850s was because of a technological change. What technological change am I referring to? Come on, somebody's got to know the answer to this. What happened in 1846?
Steamships.
The invention of the steamship. Good. So you have Morse code and the invention of the steamship right around the same time. So now travel is faster and less dangerous. So people who might have been reluctant to get on a sailboat in the 1830s or early 1840s, but who had good reason to try to get out of Europe, now would be more likely to tolerate the two or three week trip on steamship that was relatively safe. Okay, you just don't worry about the motion sickness. Okay, now poor Jews were more likely to go to America, while those who were slightly better off were more likely to move from rural or village areas in Central Europe to the big commercial cities like Berlin, Hamburg, Frankfurt, Vienna, and Budapest. So people with a little bit of kesef, they would stay in Europe. But they would go to the commercial centers where they could strike it, not rich necessarily, but have a better life. Those with bupkis who had nothing would just take the shirt off their shirt on their back and go to America. So the poor Jew found his craft becoming increasingly obsolete with the industrialization of society. So people who had a way of earning a livelihood in pre-modern times, well, that method of earning a livelihood might not be so lucrative anymore. It might get you to earn you nothing. Alternatively, even if you had a way of earning a livelihood that was still viable in the technologically advanced period, still, if the Gentile competitors wanted to maintain their monopoly, they could muscle you out of the realm of competition. And so it became necessary for a lot of people just to find a new homeland, as they could not earn a livelihood. The Kahal was happy to get rid of poor Jews. Sometimes it would help fund their passage to America. The expression in Yiddish, paterin is geltvert, meaning to be pater, to be exempt from them, the Hebrew word patur, to get rid of them and be done with them is worth the money. So it costs us money to pay a few dollars or a few marks to get them out of our community on a boat to America. It's money well spent. Okay. A few of Germany's Jewish elite families did send a son to America to set up an American branch of the business there. In the booming decades, the decade before the Civil War and the decade after the Civil War. So I shouldn't say that everybody who went to America was desperately poor. That wasn't the case. There was some of the elite, but they were few and far between. Another type of person who eventually made their way to America was a rabbi, the class of rabbis. Their immigration came after the migration was already in full swing. And this actually is very relevant, and we'll discuss it next week and the week after, the week after that. We get into religious issues. The German states, many of them required that rabbis hold a university degree. So starting from the 1830s and onward, you have rabbis who are secularly educated. Many times, what the secular education in the university causes them to no longer be orthodox in you know, doctrinal belief, but rather gets them on the path towards either positive historical Judaism or out-and-out Reform Judaism or radical Reform Judaism. These things happen. But even those who maintained a doctrinal traditionalism, they had experienced in the university Bildung, culture. The Jews who came to America, for the most part, had not experienced Bildung, and they came before the rabbis did, for the most part. So you had an odd situation where the communities in America, starting from the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, were culturally backward Jews who were not especially Germanized, but their rabbis were very Germanized, leading to interesting results, as we shall see. Okay. The vast bulk of migrants only had begun the process of Germanization in the years shortly before they left for America. And so they arrived in America only marginally German, basically in linguistics alone, and even that not necessarily. Plenty of them still spoke Yiddish. But they were not high-culture Germans who were coming off the boat to America in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Not at all. These were Jews who were still pretty much old-time peasant Jews. Okay. Now, some Jewish males were running away from military conscription. This is a common theme in history, and we shouldn't overlook it. We shouldn't necessarily... It's sometimes a shameful episode and sometimes not so shameful episode in our people's history. So military conscription is a big deal in 19th century Europe. Number one, because everybody's always fighting wars. Okay, but also because you finally have not the professional army of mercenary soldiers, but rather you have popular conscription, the draft. And who's subject to the draft? Anyone who's a citizen. Well, in those parts of Central and Western Europe where Jews are gaining citizenship, now they got to serve in the army. Well, who wants to serve in the army? Some people don't. And the answer is you run away. Truth be told, it wasn't just in Central and Western Europe. Even in Russia, where Jews are nowhere near emancipation and are not close to being citizens, but Tsarist Russia had the cantonist system. They're chapping kids. And if they're going to chop the kids, nobody wants to serve in the military. You run away to America. So escaping military service was an important element of this wave of immigration. Okay, there's a question in the chat. What was the reaction of pre-revolutionary Jews to the newcomers? The answer is that for the most part, they were happy to have their numbers bolstered by new arrivals because the existing communities in the Eastern Seaboard were... you know, very, very small and pretty weak. And so the influx of Jews is helpful to sustain communal institutions. They become not so happy anymore when the various minhagim of Sephard versus Ashkenaz or Sephard versus Polim, Polish rite, results in the fissure of the community and the creation of multiple synagogues. We're going to get to that soon enough. Maish is asking, what was the level of religiosity of the immigrants? So the answer is that the historiography tended to think that these were very irreligious Jews. And that's why they went to America, knowing that their religious needs could largely not be met in the Trefa Medina and in the New World. However, more likely, that's not really the case. More likely, the irreligious ones in Germany went from rural and village areas to the large cities in a process of Germanization that also resulted in them becoming less frum, personally observant in their private lives, as opposed to those who went to America who were still the old world Jew without modernization for the most part, and they would have liked to maintain their religious scruples. It's just that it became really difficult to do so in America, and so they ended up not doing so. And the American Jew, the German-American Jew, just like the German-German Jew, in the period of 1820 to 1880, is on a trajectory away from religious piety, but not necessarily because they wanted it to be that way. It just, it worked out that way. Len is asking, were the German-Jewish banking families involved in the slave trade? And the answer to that is no, because the German-Jewish banking families were basically not involved in the commerce in America prior to the Civil War, since they had no representation in America prior to the Civil War. It's only afterwards that Rothschild-type institutions make a presence felt in America, and German Jews who came poor to America but became wealthy developed the American Jewish banking institutions with, you know, their German ethnic background, but all this is post-Civil War. Okay. Now, restriction... Okay, so one other thing that led to immigration to the United States was a crisis abroad. Cholera epidemics and famine, especially in the 1860s in Lithuania, in Suvalk and Kalvari provinces, there was disease and starvation leads people out. Sort of like the Irish, you know, have the potato famine out to America, so the Lithuanian Jews and Jews of that geographic region. Okay. Restrictions on marriage made it very difficult for a Jew in Germany to set up house and family in the town of your parents. Typically, only one child in the family was allowed to sustain that the family's presence in that town. Other people had to get out and find other places of domicile. Well, so the young people leave. That's why American Jewish communities in the mid-19th century had a noticeable absence of old people and, for that matter, an absence of young children. Because who was there? Young single people. Predominantly men, but also women. Men would go find a Jewish bride through the mail. It sounds ridiculous, but they would. Through correspondence, a bride would be sent over. There was a noticeable imbalance between the number of men and women in early American German Jewish communities. There were plenty of single women, just not as many as there were men. After all, for the women, their economy dried up in Europe as well. There was less of a need for domestic service, which is what women often did. So if they can't get hired in the domestic service, they'll go to the United States and ply their trade elsewhere. Okay. Jews came to America in small groups of friends or relatives. Often siblings came together. It was typical for a friend to marry their friend's sister. So, you know, you're two guys, they're buddies, oh, why don't you marry my sister? And so it would be. It was also typical for the oldest sibling to go to America first, and then for other siblings to follow. Not all of these so-called German Jews were really German. Many of those poor Jews who came from Germany who made their way to America were actually Polish Jews or Russian Jews who had been spilling over the border into Germany in the previous few decades. But they realized that their dreams were not going to be fulfilled on German soil. And so just as they had uprooted themselves once before to go from Eastern Europe to Central Europe, they'll uproot themselves again and go from Central Europe to the United States. Of the total number of Jews migrating between 1820 and 1880 to America, probably little more than about 50% came from Germany. The rest came from where? Poland, Bohemia, Moravia, Slovakia, France, Russia, and Lithuania. Most of the Jews who came from Prussia actually came from Posen, itself a former Polish territory. It was hard to know among the immigrants, if we look at the record keeping, which ones were Jewish, because United States officials never asked questions about religion in their various forms. You know, we have separation of church and state. We don't ask you whether you're a Jew or a goy. We just want to know what citizenship you had or where you know what your national origins are. So the Yiddish-speaking Jew from a Polish area of Posen would nonetheless have German documents. And so for the records, it looks like a German Jew came to the United States, when in fact, culturally, this person was not a cultured German Jew from Berlin with an education. He was a Yiddish speaker from backward Posen. Okay. Some Jews preferred to identify as German Jew rather than to admit ignoble Eastern origins like Galicia or Hungary. In other words, everyone makes fun of the Galicianas, everyone makes fun of the Hungarischer, and with good reason sometimes. You know, they were pretty backward. All right, so if I was one of them and I lived in 1850s America, what would I say? Oh, I'm a German Jew. Why? Because the guy spoke a little German. It was a convenient way of covering up ethnic background that you thought was embarrassing. Okay, but when it came to the formation of synagogues, this ethnic background would play an important role. So there was Minhag Poland versus Minhag Ashkenaz, and they would form separate shuls. You have Hungarian shul, Romanian shul, Litvish shul, Polish shul, Suwalka congregation, and all these things existed prior to 1880. You know, there's a tendency to think that only after the pogroms of 1881 and the assassination of Tsar Alexander II that Eastern European Jews come to America. It's not true at all. Okay, you just go to the Lower East Side. The first Russish shul was 1852, based on Rish HaGadol, Rabbi Ash. Okay, so, and you had other congregations that were identifiable by the region, not the country, but the sub-region from where their members hailed. And all these existed in Eastern seaboard cities starting from the 1850s. Okay, so historians who universalize the German experience make a big mistake. After all, there were Yiddish-speaking Alsatian Jews from France. And there were also Austrian Jews. But most who came from the Habsburg Empire, it should be noted, were primitive and hardly had been touched by modernization, meaning there were maybe a handful of Jews who came from Vienna, from the capital of the Habsburg monarchy. Most came from the outlying provinces, including Galicia, and had not been touched by modernization. What about the Jews who came from England and from the Netherlands? So those people actually were not English speakers, and they didn't speak Dutch. What did they speak? They spoke Yiddish. Okay, why? Because they were Russian and Polish Jews who decided to go away from Eastern Europe and stop in Western Europe, okay, in the Benelux countries or in England. But what happened? It wasn't for them. They kept moving, and so they move on to America in the mid-19th century. Okay. Some scholars make the mistake of assuming that the Jews who came to America had only tangential connection to Judaism and that explained their willingness to travel to a religious wasteland. I mentioned this before. But that's an incorrect reading of history. Because since people were leaving for economic reasons, they had their Jewish associations still intact. The wealthier Jews who remained in Europe and went to the big cities may have been Jewishly weaker and more likely to establish the liberal congregations of Central Europe, liberal meaning reform, or to apostatize altogether and become heathens. The poorer Jews who went to America were actually more Jewish in their heart and less Germanized than the ones who stayed behind. How many people are we talking about? What are the raw numbers here? It's good to have numbers in our head. Well, the Jewish population in America in 1825, let's assume it was around 3,000 people. That's almost nothing. 3,000 is hardly anything. By 1840, it was 15,000. It's a substantial increase, a five-fold increase in a 15-year span. So you could understand why the old Sephardic congregations, the Spanish-Portuguese congregations, had been way outpaced by the newer immigration, and these guys are going to have to found their own shuls and their own organizations. By 1848, that number was 50,000. So you go from 15 to 50 in an eight-year stretch, major increase in the 1840s. And then from 50,000 in 1848 to 150,000 on the eve of the Civil War, a threefold increase. And then by 1880, 240,000. So almost a quarter million Jews live in America before the Great Wave begins in 1881. Where did this group move to? Well, they moved well beyond the eastern seaboard. if in the colonial period and the early Republican period, there were Jews who ventured into the hinterlands, still the communities basically were all along the coast. This would change. You'd have people move inland and establish communities. But how was a community established? I mean, if it doesn't exist, someone has to do something. Well, so the question is, what percentage of the total population? Still infinitesimal. On the eve of the Civil War, let's assume Jews were not more than a half of 1%. Okay, so not like it was later where Jews would become, you know, 3 to 4% of the total population. Right. So how did the community develop? A person, a lone individual, or maybe two or three people, will arrive on the scene in a frontier town as bachelors. They had been peddlers, and now they want to be shopkeepers. And so they open up the shop, and this is not their first stop in America. They've bounced around, but now they're ready to settle down. If the business flourishes, if it flourishes, and not all businesses flourished, but if it does, they call their siblings to join them from abroad, from Europe, and to join them in the store, in the business, in the geschäft. Then these bachelors are ready to get married because now they're financially stable. And after they get married, they have children. Once you have nuclear family units, and several of them, it's time to build the infrastructure of a keilah, of a community, which may mean a synagogue or other types of institutions. It may mean a cemetery or it may mean a social organization. We'll see. Let's talk about, for a few minutes, the economic profile of this crowd of people arriving in mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. So, was the bottom tier of the Jewish American economic ladder. Other ethnic groups also engaged in peddling, but for Jews, it was a near universal experience in 19th century America. So, yes, yeah, some Irish peddled, and some German Goyim peddled, and some fill-in-the-blank ethnic background peddled, but all the Jews peddled. Peddling offered a way out of a dead-end job in New York and an opportunity for self-employment. This is a big deal, self-employment. After all, in America, we're all trying to be self-made and to find success. Well, you do so not by being someone else's hired employee, but by being your own boss. Some states required a peddler's license for you to operate in the hinterland. But there was hardly any enforcement of this at all. So it's maybe on the books, but nobody cared. Peddling was a bridge occupation. It required no real change in lifestyle or a shift in values, meaning it allowed a person to bridge their existence from the old world style to a new world American Jew without upsetting their thought process, or for that matter, their method of earning a livelihood, in the sense that they were accustomed to this sort of thing back in Europe, and now they'll do it again in America, but under more auspicious terms. And in a friendlier climate. It served as a common experience and a unifying force for Jews of various geographic backgrounds and helped solidify the American Jewish community. Meaning, if I'm a Jew from Galicia, and he's a Jew from Bavaria, and he's a Jew from Posen, and he's a Jew from Moravia, so we're not all the same. We have our ethnic differences based upon geography. Our dialect of Yiddish might be a little bit different. Our religious scruples might be a little bit different. But if we all do peddling and we gather together on Shabbos to celebrate the Jewish Sabbath after a week's long peddling, so we have a common experience that will help form a cohesive community. That whereas beforehand we were, you know, different in a variety of ways, now we have this common current experience. Okay. So peddlers would go, each one would go their own route. And they would have a rendezvous point for late Friday afternoon to gather for Shabbos in some little town. How did Jews who came with almost nothing buy the necessary stuff, wares, goods, to go around peddling to sell to the isolated farmhouses of the hinterland? Where did they get the money to do this? So the answer is that the conventional American lenders typically would not want to give a loan to an itinerant Jewish peddler right off the boat from Germany, who who doesn't speak much English and is not likely or may not be so likely to succeed. So because you can't access capital from the goy, what do? You go to the Jewish lenders. So here there was a certain camaraderie where the Jew with a little bit of kesef in his pocket is able to extend that to a newcomer so that the newcomer can then ply his trade as a peddler gallivanting all around. Typically, peddlers were single and shopkeepers were married. It wasn't always true. Sometimes peddlers were married and left their homes and left their wife and family for a week on end or more to go find customers. But more typically, the ones who were out and about with the pack on their back or with a wagon were bachelors. And when they were ready to stop that and they had sufficient money to run a shop, then they got married. Okay. The more successful peddlers turned merchants would go back to Europe to find a much younger bride and then move her back to America. Other peddlers found wives during stopovers in existing Jewish communities where they would announce themselves, I'm looking for a wife, and the girls would be presented by their parents if they were of age. So peddling served several specific practical functions for the new immigrants. It helped them accumulate capital and learn about America and Americans, meaning you have to learn about this society. If you were to live in a cloistered, homogeneous ethnic enclave in one of the eastern seaboard cities, would you really know about America? I mean, even Ad Hayom Hazeh, plenty of us American New York Jews have no clue what it's like west of the Hudson, except maybe Teaneck, all right? But I mean, Jews who live in a very narrow world of fellow Jews, they don't know about real America. The peddlers, they found out about real America because they had to interact with them, find customers, and earn a livelihood. Also, it offered bachelors a way to have enough money to marry. It grew out of a traditional Jewish economic activity and sustained Jewish communal life because these peddlers would come back to the community to have their religious needs met. The fabulous stories of a peddler who would go on to become a super wealthy department store magnate, those stories are true. But those stories are few and far between. We shouldn't think that a rags to riches tale was for everybody. It was for some people, and yeshikar to them, but only a handful. Most peddlers were happy to graduate to a small store selling clothing or dry goods. Now, for making it in America, Jews did not have to wean themselves off of their old pre-modern economic practices. Rather, what had made them a pariah in Europe, in America, made them a respectable, solid citizen. Because in America, we admire the self-made businessman. So in the sense that in Europe, the Jew was criticized for being a middleman, for not being productive, for not creating something with his hands, whether it be in agriculture or handicraft, but rather for just giving from person A to person B and making a profit off of it. So profiteering and wholesaling and middlemaning in Europe was seen as a dirty Jewish practice, which the Jews should have to get rid of if they want to achieve citizenship. They should make themselves more productive and till the soil and create. In America, nobody cared about that, or at least most people didn't care about that. What mattered was, were you economically useful? And the middleman definitely is economically useful, all right? So it's only an anti-Semitic canard to say that the middleman is not useful. So it's interesting that whereas Jews in Europe were told they needed to improve their moral worth by way of changing their economic profile and their cultural profile, and maybe even reforming their religion too, in order to be deserving of citizenship and having the state, the Christian state, be able to confer upon them the favor of citizenship. In America, it's the other way around. Just, you know, be economically successful and we'll be very proud of you. Okay. Now, during the German period of 1820 to 1880, American Jews created fraternal organizations, many fraternal organizations. So Asher, last time you mentioned B'nai B'rith, I'm going to mention that now. So B'nai B'rith was founded in 1843. The rabbis, who are non-existent in America until the 1840s, but then come on the scene in large numbers after that, the rabbis complained that the lodge was replacing the synagogue, and had effectively become the secular synagogue. Secular synagogue. Why did this happen? Well, lodges were cheaper to maintain than were synagogues, and demanded a lot less of the private behavior of its members, in the sense that in the shul, well, if you want to be get an aliyah, you want to be an officer of the shul, you can't be openly eating treif for chazer. You can't be working your store on Shabbos. You know, there's expectations in the synagogue before it turns reform. Once it turns reform, it's all fair game. But before, when it's still a traditional synagogue of an immigrant variety, there are things that we expect of you to be an Eilech HaYid and a Frum Yid. And if you're not, well, you're out. In the fraternal lodges, there's no demand made upon your private behavior in terms of Jewish piety. No, we don't really care at all. So there's a gradual shift in the center of gravity in the Jewish community, away from the synagogue and away from the school and toward the charitable organization. So we have to ask ourselves, why did this happen? Why did it happen? So first of all, and this is a very important point, there's the American separation of church and state. So the clergy and the house of worship have no juridical or police power over the co-religionists, who then went where the demands were fewer. So pardon me if I offend anybody by saying this, what's the modern equivalent of that? What's the 21st century equivalent of going where the demands are fewer? Chabad, of course. With Chabad, you don't have to pay $3,000 dues to the Young Israel, and you don't have to do X, Y, or Z with the building fund. The rich macher gives the guy, the shliach, $1 million, and he puts up a building, and the average Chaim Yankel just shows up high holidays and maybe makes a donation. And you can bar mitzvah a kid for nothing. As opposed to in the shuls, in the conservative shul, you have to send your kid to cheder or to Talmud Torah, and he has to come every Saturday for a year. Nobody wants to go. They hate it. So there are all sorts of demands made upon the Jew by the synagogue, whereas the lodge of the 1840s, 50s, 60s doesn't make those demands. Chabad of today doesn't make those demands. But Chabad does great work. I'm just saying it's analogous. Okay. So the question from the Hammermans, the lodges then are equivalent to JCCs now. Yes, there's a significant overlap between what the fraternal organizations of 150 years ago were and the JCCs of today. It was an opportunity for socializing, for mixing and mingling together with Jews, and for fun activities, but without the burden of religious observance. Okay. Now, also, Jews wanted to be more Americanized and to affiliate in the same manner as their Gentile neighbors. Okay? So 19th century Americans were inveterate joiners of clubs. They're always joining a club, the Lions Club, the Rotary Club, the Freemasons, every club. So the Jews want to do the same thing. Well, what kind of clubs do the Jews have? So they have societies for charity, for the burial of the dead, for visiting the sick, for socializing, and all well and good. So Chevra Kadisha, Bikur Cholim, and just Stamazoy having fun. All these things are very nice, and they don't produce much conflict. By contrast, what produces a lot of conflict? Religion. Religion is always a controversial topic, and theological differences will result in people being angry with each other, and yelling and barking, and fighting and creating breakaway organizations. Okay, Asher says, the service organization was more accepting of all strands of Judaism and attended to the widows and the orphans. That is correct. Bingo. So where is the synagogue?
I'm looking at a plaque that emblazes on it benevolence, brotherly love, and harmony as the motto of B'nai B'rith, the Mother Lodge. So that could not be so controversial.
Right. So it's exactly the point. It's not controversial. They're doing chesed ben adam l'chaveiro, between man and man, that nobody could complain about. Everybody agrees that philanthropy is a virtue, and Jews should associate themselves with philanthropic societies. That we only have machlokes when we're dealing with ritual religion and, for that matter, abstract belief. Okay. What was the state of educational institutions around this time? The answer is it wasn't good at all. It was not good at all. The old pre-revolutionary congregations, some of them had schools, but as I mentioned, the one at Sheriff Israel in New York was a flop. It had to cease functioning in the early 1810s. And the Sunday school, the notion of the Jewish child going to a Sunday school where they would receive religious instruction was an invention of Rebecca Gratz in Philadelphia in 1838. But that didn't teach very much at all. If you wanted to be a functional synagogue Jew, you know, literate in Hebrew and ability to read out of the Siddur and the Chumash, maybe the Torah, the Sunday education was nowhere near enough. And what about any higher education for Jews? Nothing. It's not going to be until the 1850s that the first attempt of like a high school for Jews to teach them Yiddishkeit will be established by Isaac Meir Wise. It was called Zion College, and it was in Cincinnati, and it also was a flop. Followed by Maimonides College in Philadelphia in 1867 under Isaac Leiser, which was also a flop. So Jewish education was not very good. Anyone who knew anything knew it because they came from Europe knowing it, not because they learned it in America. Okay, so.
May I?
Yeah.
Also, you know, the element of kashrut, you know, this was unheard of. I only learned about this when I joined more than 50 years ago. That they intentionally, the lodges, would have their functions in restaurants that were not kosher. And only slowly through the pressure of newcomers in the order that they evolve into observing at least official functions to be kosher.
Well, and the successor to that was UJA, where they would always have dietary laws observed, you know, at the bottom of the invitation to whatever a function, dietary laws observed.
Right.
At various junctures in American Jewish history, the observance of kashrut by philanthropic organizations so as to satisfy the wishes of their more traditional members was a thing. Unfortunately, in more recent decades, it became less of a thing, actually, unless this was an Orthodox organization that was catering to its own constituency. Okay, now in America, many new religions popped up. And there was much experimentation within the existing denominations. Why did this happen? Well, the state was indifferent toward religious behavior of the citizenry. This is certainly true at the federal level, and eventually it's true at the state level too, where there is no discrimination on the basis of church affiliation after a few decades into the 19th century. And people were in the mood for new things. This led to an erosion in the power of the clergy and the power and status of religion more generally. The westward movement and constant mobility tended to break religious control. Meaning, if you're a shul or a rabbi, and your congregant is only here for a little while, he's transient, then he's going to go there and there and there, and everybody's moving all the time, how do you exert any real religious influence over the private behavior of your constituents? They're not even your constituents. They're moving around, okay? And if they go further west, they're on their own. And when you're on your own, when the cat's away, the mice will play. So eating treif and working Shabbos and intermarrying and all sorts of flagrant violations will be happening galore. Okay. Now, Americans changed their denominations as easily as they changed. It was a joke, basically. People were not committed to whatever denomination of Protestantism they might be with at any one point. They would walk away from it if they found something nicer. And the denominations, therefore, diluted their theological differences as they all chased for the same batch of potential parishioners. So nobody has real core beliefs anymore. Everybody's just searching for a congregant within the realm of Protestantism. Social and economic standing tended to be the dividing line between the various sects of Christianity, not substantive differences in their spiritual teaching. So why is any of this relevant for the Jews? Because the same thing will hold true for the Jews. Social standing will end up being a major difference in synagogue affiliation, with the old established congregations being for the moneyed elite and the newer ones being established by people who feel excluded, whether because they didn't have the right ethnic background or they didn't have enough cash. Okay, and as for theological differences, not much of one, at least not until the big reform rabbis come on the scene in the 1850s and espouse all sorts of heresies. Okay, so also women get heavily involved in religious politics of the 19th century, and this is true among the Jews as well, that female involvement in synagogue life forces a major issue, one being the mixed pew, that in the Reform synagogues of the United States, as opposed to the Reform synagogues of Europe, you'll have mixed seating. Okay, so for traditional Judaism, for Catholicism, and for Lutheranism, all these religions that have an old world hierarchical structure and a strong clergy, they face in America at this time dual challenges of pluralistic and privatized American religious culture. Now, let me emphasize that again. Pluralistic in the sense that you can't coerce people to do things your way. They can make up their own church and their own synagogue, and now you have a range of denominations. In pre-modern times, that couldn't happen. And also privatized. The church can't control me. The synagogue can't control me. I may not be interested in establishing a competitor synagogue or a competitor church with a new name of a denomination. I may just be indifferent. And I'll involve myself to whatever extent I want to involve myself, but otherwise I'm private when it comes to matters of religion. You can't force me to keep mitzvot. And so I'll keep as few as I feel like. Okay, there were other questions. The question was, when did the Talmud Torah take root, the synagogue Talmud Torah? The answer to that is not really until 1900 or thereabout, because that's when you have Mordechai Kaplan and the young bucks turning to the Eastern European Jewish communities of the Lower East Side and seeking to create the downtown Talmud. Well, actually, the downtown Talmud Torah was around already from the 1880s. I take it back. So already in the 1880s, just at the beginning of the great wave of Russian Jews to America, you have the notion of the synagogue Talmud Torah, and it takes off even further in the interwar period. Okay, Hadassah functions not strictly kosher. You can order a glatt kosher meal if you wish. That's true, because Hadassah is a Zionist organization, not a religious organization. Last question, what was the Jewish response to the religious Great Awakening? Ah, very interesting question. So the answer to that is there were Jews who in the 1820s and 1830s tried to have a Great Awakening among Jews. There was Samuel Jackson who wrote The Jew. That was a publication of his. And it was an attempt to defend Jews away from Christian missionary work, because Christian missionary work becomes a relevant factor around that era. And how do you defend against Christian missionaries? Only by strengthening the religious convictions of Jews. If Jews have very weak religious convictions, they're easy targets for the galach and for the person who's looking to ameliorate the religious status of the Jew by dint of baptism and Christianity. So you have to strengthen the Jews. Well, Isaac Leiser is a force to be reckoned with in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and is a one-man show in trying to strengthen religious life among Jews and offering a traditional approach rather than that of a reform one. His ideological adversaries will be advocating reform, which we'll have to address in the next few weeks. Whether that was just a matter of convenience to strip away mitzvah observance or based upon some deep thought. So last one, does Chabad play with fire in minimizing or opposing Zionism? How do they reconcile the Judaism with Zionism? Asher, it's for another time. We'll have to stop here. Everybody have a good night, and we'll see you all next week. Next week we'll discuss, I said we'll get to it, the Charleston Experiment in Reform. 1824, the first attempt to tinker with the service. It doesn't work. It failed. But in the long run, reform was victorious. See you next time.
Thank you.